1,200 people were massacred. Many young people who were simply attending a music festival. Women were horribly raped. As I said then, I say today, Israel had a right, has a right to defend itself, we would. And how it does so matters. Far too many innocent Palestinians have been killed. And we have got to get a deal done. We were in Doha. Mm-hmm. We have to get a deal done. This war must end.
In the meantime.
And we must get a deal that is about getting the hostages out. I've met with the families of the American hostages. Let's get the hostages out. Let's get the ceasefire done.
But no change in policy in terms of arms and so forth.
No, we have to get a deal done. Dana, we have to get a deal done. When you look at the significance of this to the families, to the people who are living in that region, a deal is not only the right thing to do to end this war, but will unlock so much of what must happen next. I remain committed since I've been on October 8th to what we must do to work toward a two-state solution, where Israel is secure and in equal measure the Palestinians have security and self-determination and dignity.
That's Kamala Harris. For more, we are joined by Yusuf Munayyir, Palestinian-American analyst, head of Palestine-Israel program at Arab Center in Washington, D.C., joining us from Virginia. Your response to what she said, Yusuf?
Well, to put it simply, it was quite pathetic. There was, as we saw there, a no on the question of whether there will be a change in policy. And let's be perfectly clear about what the current Biden-Harris administration policy is. It's the continued and unprecedented support through consistent weapon supplies to the Israeli military as it carries out a horrific genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza, where somewhere between 40,000 and perhaps up to 200,000 people, according to some estimates, have already been killed. 80% of the structures in Gaza have been damaged or destroyed, and nearly 2 million people are homeless, displaced, and living under dire humanitarian conditions due to a tightening siege. That's the policy that Vice President Harris is committing to continue. And I think that that's, of course, outrageous. And in her answer, you know, she continued to go back to this idea that we need to get a ceasefire. We need to get a ceasefire. And of course, we need to get a ceasefire. Congratulations to Vice President Harris on getting to where the international community was last November. But why aren't we there? Well, the key reason we are not there is because of the United States' continued and consistent support to the Israeli military so that it can continue carrying out this genocide. And of course, there was no follow-up question from Bash there on that, where there absolutely should have been. And here I just want to make a point about the way that this question was sort of presented and framed. I think you played it a moment ago. It's important for journalists to be able to hold our elected officials accountable and to ask these questions. But I'm wondering, who was the journalist here holding the candidate accountable to? The way that this question was framed, will you consider ending or modifying aid to Israel as some folks on the progressive left want you to do, suggests that the journalist is trying to hold her to account to some sort of position in the American center. But that's not where people are. In fact, the vast majority of Democrats, as we've seen in polls, time and again, are now supporting an end to arms to Israel. The majority of independents are supporting an end to arms shipments to Israel. And in fact, nearly 40% of Republicans are at that place now, according to a recent CBS poll in June, that they also support an end to arms to Israel at this time. That's where the Biden-Harris administration is, to the right of 40% of Republicans. So the real question should have been, When are you going to start enforcing U.S. law as it relates to arms shipments? Because what we are doing right now with this U.S. government policy is in violation not just of international law, but also of American law. And Vice President Harris made it very clear in other parts of her interview that she wants to be a prosecutor. She wants to enforce the law. But Israel here is clearly getting an exception from the Harris campaign.
Do you think there's any difference between Kamala Harris and Joe Biden? Everywhere Joe Biden went, you know, including, I mean, we're going into Labor Day, Biden and Harris will be together in Pittsburgh, big labor rally. When he went to see the UAW months ago, when he was running for president, they were supporting him, but also many were holding up signs around Gaza, calling for a ceasefire. You have that interview done yesterday, Thursday, I think around 1:30. At around 5 in Savannah, where she and Walls held a big rally, a massive rally of thousands of people, she was also interrupted by pro-peace Palestinian supporters, Yusuf.
Well, look, there doesn't seem to be any noticeable difference on policy. In fact, she said as much yesterday during the interview. And if there is any indication that there is going to be a difference, it might be, as hard as it is to believe, that Harris could be worse than Biden. The president, despite his unprecedented support for this Israeli genocide over all of these months, has in the past come out and said that there is indiscriminate bombing by Israel, that Benjamin Netanyahu, it's fair to believe he's playing politics with the ceasefire, and that's why it's not getting done, that the protesters, as he said at the DNC convention, have a point because of how many civilians are being killed. That's not something we've heard from Kamala Harris so far. We've just heard the sort of pro-Israel talking point boilerplate that she led with yesterday, and an empty answer on policy change.
Let's talk about the uncommitted vote and what happened at the DNC. You have many people represented on the stage on many different issues. A call of the uncommitted vote, the more than 30 delegates from around the country and the 300 self-proclaimed pro-ceasefire delegates, though I'm sure if a poll was done, there were many more, calling for a Palestinian-American speaker on the stage. Can you talk about what happened there and where uncommitted goes from here? They, in their sit-in, being very disappointed by not having a Palestinian-American address the convention, called for Kamala Harris to come to Dearborn by September 15th to meet with the Palestinian community there.
Well, I certainly don't speak for the uncommitted movement, but it's very clear that that did not take place at the DNC. There was no Palestinian speaker allowed to be on the stage to speak their truth about what is happening to Palestinians, thanks to U.S. support for Israel. And you know, that request from the uncommitted movement was, I think, the simplest of asks. You know, listen to what a Palestinian has to say. And if, you know, the Harris campaign, if this is representative of what her administration is going to do, does not even have the political courage and wherewithal to hear from a single Palestinian speaker, how are voters who care about this issue supposed to believe that she is going to have the political courage to do what it takes to press the Israelis to end this genocidal campaign in Gaza, and moreover, to actually get to the policy goal that she did mention in her comments in her interview, which is, of course, a Palestinian state and some form of self-determination and dignity. So I think clearly there was a failure of a test here to demonstrate that they're willing to do something, anything on this issue. And it was also reflected, frankly, in how unprepared she was for the answer that she gave yesterday on a question that everybody knew was coming. She simply could not give a clear answer on what change needs to happen to get to the ceasefire that this administration has failed to deliver.
Yousef Munayyer is head of the Palestine-Israel program at the Arab Center, Washington, D.C. We're going to turn now to the economy. During the nearly half-hour CNN interview, Vice President Harris was asked about her top priorities if elected president of the United States. She's interviewed by CNN's Dana Bash.
The voters are really eager to hear what your plans are. If you are elected, what would you do on day one in the White House?
Well, there are a number of things. I will tell you, first and foremost, one of my highest priorities is to do what we can to support and strengthen the middle class.
So what would you do day one?
Day one, it's going to be about, one, implementing my plan for what I call an opportunity economy. I've already laid out a number of proposals in that regard, which include what we're going to do to bring down the cost of everyday goods, what we're going to do to invest in America's small businesses, what we're going to do to invest in families, for example, extending the child tax credit to $6,000 for families for the first year of their child's life to help them buy a car seat, to help them buy baby clothes, a crib. There's the work that we're going to do that is about investing in the American family around affordable housing, a big issue in our country right now. So there are a number of things on day one.
What about you?
Well, I'm excited about this agenda, too. As I said, the idea of inspiring America to what can be. And I think many of these things that the vice president's proposing are things that we share in values. And the child tax credit is one we know that reduces childhood poverty by a third. We did it in Minnesota to have a federal partner in this. Unbelievable, I think, in the impact that we can make.
You maintain Bidenomics is a success.
I maintain that when we do the work of bringing down prescription medication for the American people, including capping the cost of the annual cost of prescription medication for seniors at $2,000, when we do what we did in the first year of being in office to extend the child tax credit so that we cut child poverty in America by over 50%, when we do what we have done to invest in the American people and bringing manufacturing back to the United States so that we created over 800,000 new manufacturing jobs, bringing business back to America, what we have done to improve the supply chain so we're not relying on foreign governments to supply American families with their basic needs, I'll say that that's good work. There's more to do, but that's good work.
That's the Democratic ticket, Kamala Harris for president and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz at her side in this interview as they sat in Savannah, Georgia. We're also joined by Nikhil Goyal, a sociologist, educator, author of the book Live to See the Day, Coming of Age in American Poverty. Nikhil, thanks so much for joining us. Can you respond to what Vice President Harris calls the opportunity economy that she'll be pushing on day one?
Sure. Thanks for having me. Kamala Harris laid out a very bold economic agenda for working families in this country. She will restore the expanded child tax credit by putting $6,000 in the pockets of every newborn child, up to $3,600 per child annually until the age of 18. We know how important that first year of a child's life is for that person's development and how it sets the course for years to come. This measure will ultimately reduce child poverty and economic insecurity. It will reduce food insecurity. It will put money in people's pockets. It will make it easier for families to afford childcare, housing, healthcare, and basic essentials. And, you know, we saw how transformative the expanded child tax credit was when it was implemented in 2021 in bringing child poverty down to the lowest level in recorded history. And now is an opportunity to resurrect it with a Democratic-controlled House and Senate and pass an economic agenda that will uplift the dignity of every working person in this country.
And how that compares to President Trump and J.D. Vance?
Oh, the contrast could not be more clear. When we passed the child tax credit in 2021, not a single Republican supported that measure. And if you put the agenda that President Harris is putting forward to the Republican Party, I expect not a single member of the Republican Party to support that. Donald Trump has shown that he will cut the social safety net. He will erode union protections and other workers' rights. He will not support Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. You know, he fights for the billionaire class. And Kamala Harris, with this vision, with this agenda, shows that she is on the side of working people, of public schools, of educators, of ordinary Americans of all stripes.
I want to turn now to the issue of climate, which hasn't come up that much during this presidential campaign, but it was addressed Thursday when CNN's Dana Bash questioned Vice President Harris about her change in position on the methane gas drilling process known as fracking, which saw a boom in the U.S. and Canada and has been linked to a surge in methane gas emissions over the past decade, which are one of the biggest contributors to the climate crisis.
When you were in Congress, you supported the Green New Deal. And in 2019, you said, quote, there is no question I'm in favor of banning fracking. Fracking, as you know, is a pretty big issue, sure, particularly in your must-win state of Pennsylvania.
Sure.
Do you still want to ban fracking?
No, and I made that clear on the debate stage in 2020, that I would not ban fracking. As vice president, I did not ban fracking. As president, I will not ban fracking.
In 2019, I believe, in a town hall, you said you were asked, would you commit to implementing a federal ban on fracking on your first day in office? And you said, there's no question I'm in favor of banning fracking. So, yes. So it changed in that campaign?
In 2020, I made very clear where I stand. We are in 2024, and I've not changed that position, nor will I going forward. I kept my word, and I will keep my word.
What made you change that position at the time?
Well, let's be clear. My values have not changed. I believe it is very important that we take seriously what we must do to guard against what is a clear crisis in terms of the climate. And to do that, we can do what we have accomplished thus far. The Inflation Reduction Act, what we have done to invest, by my calculation, over probably $1 trillion over the next 10 years, investing in a clean energy economy. What we've already done, creating over 300,000 new clean energy jobs. That tells me, from my experience as vice president, we can do it without banning fracking. In fact, Dana, I cast the tie-breaking vote that actually increased leases for fracking,
yeah,
as vice president. So I'm very clear about where I stand.
And so we turn now to David Sirota, founder and editor-in-chief of The Lever, host of its new investigative podcast, Master Plan. He's also an Oscar-nominated co-writer of Don't Look Up, that satirical film about a comet hurtling toward Earth, a metaphor for climate change. So, David, this change in position. When Kamala Harris was first running for president in 2019, right, she said she was against fracking. That's primaries. She's appealing to the base of the Democratic Party. But now she didn't have to go through the primaries, and she's appealing to the population at large. Can you respond to what she said?
Well, I think what was most problematic about what she said was that she said that the Inflation Reduction Act means that they can hit the carbon emissions targets that they want to hit, when in fact this year there was a report out quite recently saying that the Inflation Reduction Act has certainly reduced carbon emissions in the United States, but not nearly on track to what the Biden-Harris administration has projected and has pledged to hit by 2030. So she's saying the Inflation Reduction Act can bring down emissions without having to do anything like banning fracking, when the data says exactly the opposite, that there's going to be need to be much more done to reduce carbon emissions. And I think the takeaway here is what we've seen from the Biden-Harris administration generally, which is they are willing to make real investments in the supply side of clean energy. They are willing to make real investments in the green energy economy, but they have shied away from policy that would reduce the supply of oil and gas. I mean, they have expanded leases, they have expanded fracking, they have expanded drilling on public lands beyond where even President Trump expanded it, and oil production has expanded to record levels in the United States. That's not going to be enough. It is good to invest in clean energy, for sure, but the data is telling us that what Kamala Harris said about fracking, that we can do it without dealing with reducing the supply of fossil fuels, it's just not borne out by the numbers. And ultimately, the consequences for that will be on the United States. It will be for the entire world.
David Sirota, I want to ask you to stay with us for our next segment, founder and editor-in-chief of The Lever, to talk about your podcast master plan. And we also want to thank the other members of the roundtable, Youssef Munayyer with the Arab Center, sociologist Nikhil Goyal, who is the author of Live to See the Day, Coming of Age in American Poverty, and longtime immigrant activist Erica Andiola. We're back with David in a moment.
Blood, 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 blood and fire. Blood, blood, blood and fire. Mercy, Lord. There is no more water to out the fire. There is no more water to out the fire.
Blood and fire here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at a major new investigation into how political extremists and corporate forces are orchestrating a system of legalized corruption in the United States. A new podcast series from The Lever aims to expose their scheme. It's called Master Plan. It's narrated by David Sirota, founder and editor-in-chief of The Lever. In this clip, he describes how he first became interested in following money in politics and the resulting corruption.
Can you pinpoint the exact moment when you realized how corrupt and FUBAR everything was? I can. It was after a pre-dawn bus trip to Canada.
Sarah Conju joins us live now from the U.S.-Canadian border in Highgate with more on the story. Sarah?
Roger, it's a matter of consumers paying one price here in the U.S. and a different price just 40 feet from where I'm standing.
It was the year 2000. I was a few years out of college following my dreams of good government and progress that I'd seen on the West Wing. I scored my first big job in politics working for a then-obscure New England congressman who'd started busing seniors to Canada in search of lower-priced prescription drugs.
So then the question comes, why is it that the same exact prescription drug manufactured in the United States of America is sold here in Canada or in Mexico or in Europe at far, far lower prices than that product is sold in the United States? That is insane.
He was right. It is insane. And he had a plan to fix it. A bill that would allow American pharmacies to buy cheaper drugs from Canada and sell them to Americans at the lower world market prices. It was a common sense idea that seemed popular in both parties. Some Democrats even started campaigning on the issue in the 2000 election. I worked for one of them in Montana, a farmer running for Senate who was organizing similar bus trips to Canada.
We didn't ask people when they got on those buses for Canada if they were Republicans or Democrats or libertarians or vegetarians. We only asked them if you would like to make a difference. We said that we would embarrass Congress into action. And over a year ago when we started these trips, Congress had never heard about the problem about prescription drugs. Now everybody's got a solution.
The pressure campaign worked. More lawmakers from both parties sponsored the bill. It got votes in the House and Senate. It passed Congress, and President Bill Clinton signed it. To 25-year-old me, it seemed the system had worked. There was a problem, the public pressured its government, the legislative machine went to work, and the wrong was righted. But then the hammer came down.
A congressional plan to reduce Americans' medical costs today ran smack into a roadblock.
I remember hearing the news. I was in my tiny D.C. apartment.
Secretary of Health Donna Shalala, in a letter to the president, has now scuttled the plan by citing serious flaws and loopholes which undermine the potential for cost savings.
The trickery was grotesque. Lawmakers issued their press releases touting the passage of a bill that promised to lower the cost of prescription drugs, but the pharmaceutical industry had been funneling millions of dollars to both political parties, and lobbyists got their allies in Congress to slip a loophole into the bill. Then the Clinton administration used that loophole to kill the program before it could ever go into effect.
Since she couldn't certify that American consumers wouldn't get lower prices, she didn't want to hold out false hope and be involved in something she thought was not legitimate.
The Clinton White House made this announcement right after Christmas, when everyone was on break. The kind of timing often used in Washington to make sure nobody notices something bad is happening. The whole thing reeked of corruption. And today, the price of medicine continues to skyrocket.
Last January, prices of more than 800 medications went up. It hurts those without insurance and even those with it.
That's a clip from the podcast series from The Lever called Master Plan. For more, we're joined by its host, David Sirota, founder and editor-in-chief of The Lever. His new Rolling Stone article is headlined, How the 2024 Election is Normalizing Corruption. David, thanks for staying with us. Why don't you lay out this this series that you've been working on for a long time?
The premise of the series is that we live in a world where the campaign finance system has been deregulated and anti-corruption laws have been gutted. We've seen that recently at the Supreme Court, but we've seen it at the Supreme Court and in our politics really for decades. And I think we understand implicitly, polls show that people understand that we're living in a time when money completely and thoroughly dominates politics. Every day you wake up, there are headlines about how much money is flooding into the political system, and it feels like that's just the natural course of events. But what we trace through never-before-reported documents is that this was a plan, a specific plan to deregulate the campaign finance laws that started about 50 years ago with something called the Powell Memo. Back then, Lewis Powell, on his way to becoming the Supreme Court Justice, issued a memo, wrote a memo about how corporations needed to reinvest in trying to take over the U.S. government because the government had been becoming too democratically responsive. And so part of the plan that came out of that Powell memo was a plan to destroy the post-Watergate campaign finance reforms and to destroy any future campaign finance reforms. Soon after that, you saw the Buckley v. Valeo case, which enshrined the radical legal doctrine that money in politics is not corruption. Money in politics is constitutionally protected speech. That came out of groups, that case came out of groups inspired by the Powell memo. Soon after that, Lewis Powell on the Supreme Court extended those free speech rights to corporations trying to spend unlimited amounts of money in elections. That ruling from Lewis Powell ended up becoming the basis for Citizens United. Citizens United, written by, of course, Lewis Powell's immediate successor on the court, Anthony Kennedy, himself a former corporate lobbyist, famous for doling out money in Sacramento in that legislature there. And that ruling, of course, says that money cannot be regulated, spent in elections if it comes from so-called independent expenditure committees. And that ruling now has allowed an explosion of campaign cash into our political system. And finally, after that came a string of rulings essentially weakening the federal bribery statute so that it's almost impossible to prosecute corruption and bribery, straight up bribery. So the point being here is that people who are watching this understand that the system is dominated by money. I think what we unearth, again, through never before reported documents, is that it was a specific plan to deregulate the campaign finance system by people who knew they couldn't get their way on policy unless they were able to short-circuit democracy. To my mind, this is the real crisis of democracy, allowing our democracy to be bought.
And we just have 20 seconds. How is this election normalizing corruption, David?
Well, when you look at Donald Trump running out there saying to oil donors, I'll give me $1 billion and I will give you the policies that you want. When you see, to my mind, Democrats trying to avoid taking too many positions that might offend their corporate donors. When you see Democrats, big donors, demanding, for instance, they fire Lina Khan, and that none of that seeming like a scandal, all of it seeming like that's just the way politics is done. We are in an era where that kind of corruption is now normal.
We have to leave it there. David Sirota, editor-in-chief of The Lever, the Mad podcast series Master Plan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life. At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities all across Canada, and we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn more.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.